Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And I can't say it enough that the debt that we're looking at on that national debt clock, as they continually spend with breakneck speed on things that they have no authority to spend on, that is unconstitutional. That's fraud, folks. And they've been doing it for well over a century. And so their excuse is, well, we've been doing it. We've been getting away with it. And so, you know, everybody else is doing it kind of thing. So anyway, we've also got Tammy Young back.
Hello.
Welcome back. And we're actually covering the Constitution today, folks, because today is Constitution Day. In other words, technically, most places kind of, you know, recognize Constitution Week, which starts on September 17th, and it goes for 1 week. Now, we give a little bit more emphasis to the Constitution, so it'll probably be Constitution Month. We got a lot of other content to cover, but we just can't say Happy Constitution Day. And if we were disingenuous, we wouldn't even say that. But it is so important that we understand the Constitution. And as I said, and I say this whenever I can think about it, there's nobody else doing this. There's nobody else teaching you what the truth is, exactly what those words are. They're not reading you what Madison actually said, what the framers actually said. They just tell you, oh, well, this is kind of the intent. It's almost like we're living under the age of Catholicism under the Roman Catholic Empire. Are you familiar with what life was like back then when, you know, Martin Luther challenged the Catholic Church?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so basically they just said, well, this is how it is because we tell you so, because they didn't allow you to even read the scriptures. And then all of a sudden it became kind of important, and it actually became this a real change in paradigm amongst Christianity that we couldn't trust those people in cloth anymore, that we actually had to read the scriptures for ourselves, which was, kind of the beginning of the Reformation of Christianity. We as a people in this government, under this government, I should say, over the past 200-some years, we have failed to understand the law. And as Thomas Jefferson says, ignorance of the law is no excuse in any country, because if we do become ignorant, I'm paraphrasing because I could pull up the citation, but paraphrasing is just as important. Because if we do become ignorant, they can pretend the law. Oh, well, yeah, that's the law. And just like the Catholic Church. And that's the way we're living today. They're making it up as they go along. So that's what happens when you let the kids run the candy store. So what we're going to do, and this is this may be a little bit of getting used to, but Tammy's going to read out of the violations of the Constitution. So I'll try to be cognitive of precisely, you know, what parts are being violated. But Tammy, as you read, you can say, okay, this is being violated. This is a real severe violation. If you can, if not, then I'll try to make sure we highlight that. But the other thing that we need to do is we also need to lay out what it is. In other words, every line, every word in the Constitution is an enumeration. Not every word in every line is an enumeration of a power. In other words, there are roles and responsibilities. They're kind of the same thing. There are powers. There are properties that are enumerated in the Constitution. There is even criminal jurisdiction enumerated in the Constitution. There are restrictions enumerated in the Constitution. And then there are standards or qualifications or so forth. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay, great. And so what we want to do is we want to make sure that we let you know what this is. If this is a power, this means that they have the ability to exercise either that power or power over that. In other words, they can create regulations over this power and so forth. So if it's a role responsibility, that doesn't mean they have the authority to create laws over that. In other words, 9 times out of 10, and almost all of the Constitution are primarily roles, responsibilities, properties, criminal jurisdiction, restrictions, and standards, none of which the federal government has the discretion to change, because those are enumerations that were given by the state, empowering them with those roles, responsibilities, and powers. If for any reason there needs to be a change, then it must be changed by the states who are the parties to it, which is why we have in the Constitution the Article 5 process. The Article 5 process is two different ways of actually amending the Constitution. And we dive into that here a lot, but we're not going to I'm not going to focus on to convene a convention or not to convene a convention. You know, I don't want to get philosophical like Shakespeare, nor do I actually want to get caught up in the conventionite, anti-conventionite paradigm. This is all about helping you understand the Constitution, what these lines mean, and whether they're being violated and so forth. So, without any further ado, let's go ahead and get started. And actually, to get started, the first thing that you're going to read, Tammy, is you're going to read a preamble, which starts off with "We the People." To be clear, there are three preambles, and I want to make sure I remember when we hit the other two, because starting off is pretty easy. But when you hit one in the middle of the Constitution, it's kind of important to say, hold on here, what you're going to read is a preamble and a restriction. So a preamble is basically a preliminary statement, or basically an introduction to a formal document that explains its purpose. In other words, this preamble is explaining the purpose of this formal document we call the Constitution. So therefore, the preamble is really just a preliminary statement. It grants no powers. It creates no roles, responsibilities. It is just, you know, this declaration of why this document exists and what you need to know is in the document, not the preamble. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay, great. So Article 1, Section 1 starts us off, but actually what I want you to do is go ahead and read the "We the People."
Okay. "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America."
Okay, so pretty simple. This is why they're doing this. All right, so the very first thing in Article 1, Section 1, is the powers of legislation. So go ahead and read the powers of legislation.
"All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives."
Okay, so what that means is all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in Congress. This is being violated because when the president creates an executive order that creates a law, or when the courts make a ruling that creates a law, those two branches of government are violating this legislative power, because it clearly says vested in Congress, and it's only vested in Congress. Okay, so the next one you're going to read, and this right here is a standard. In other words, these are qualifications. These are things that, you know, this is how you have to be. This is how it has to be this way. Okay? So for the first two paragraphs that you're going to read, Those are standards, and we'll kind of stop after you read those first two paragraphs. Go ahead.
The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. No person shall be a representative who shall not have attained to the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of the state in which he shall be chosen.
Okay, so this standard basically lays out, excuse me, the requirements or prerequisites of a representative and an elector, and that those are the only two representatives that the people will choose every 2 years for representatives, and actually the electors are chosen once every 4 years for the presidential election. And it kind of lays out the requirement of age. The next paragraph is literally a role or responsibility. So go ahead and give us that.
Representatives, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons.
Okay, so keep going all the way through this.
Okay. The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States, and within every subsequent term of 10 years, in such manner as they shall by law direct. The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative, and until such enumeration shall be made, the state of New Hampshire shall be entitled to choose 3, Massachusetts 8, Rhode Island and Providence plantations 1, Connecticut 5, New York 6, New Jersey 4, Pennsylvania 8, Delaware 1, Maryland 6, Virginia 10, North Carolina 5, South Carolina 5, and Georgia 3. When vacancies happen in the representation from any state, the executive authority thereof shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies.
Okay, so that's it, right there. So what you just read was kind of a hodgepodge of both responsibilities and standards. In other words, nothing there do they have the ability to change. As it is written, it must be followed. It must be complied to. And one of those things that they actually stated is that we the people have a right of representation. And they actually, in this paragraph, they tie representation to taxation. So it starts off with representatives and direct tax. Now, the direct tax has been changed to income tax, but they tie representation in this part of the Constitution to a direct tax, that is how they're going to tax, and that is how representation is going to be done. And representation, as you go down a little bit further, you actually mention the number of representatives shall not exceed one representative for every 30,000, and I'm saying I'm adding representative, for every 30,000, and I'm adding citizens. In other words, folks, you should not be fighting a million people to get your representative to hear what you have to say. That means that you should only be competing with 29,999 other people to get their attention. This was a big contention during the Constitutional Convention, and this is the one thing that George Washington actually put his foot down and says, I do not believe the people are properly represented when we have 40,000 people fighting and contending against each other to get their attention of their representative. And he basically said, I'd rather see that down to 30,000. It was so moved. It was seconded, and it was done. And that's why it says 30,000 and not 40,000. Okay, so the rest are really hard standards as well. And so they created these hard representations for these certain states because they really didn't know what the census was of these states. So they kind of figured based on what they believed the population was, well, okay, so that's how we're going to break up the initial representation. In 1790, they performed a census, and based on that census, they adjusted the representation to meet that 30,000 precisely. So, back to where you were. Go ahead.
Okay. The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers and shall have the sole power of impeachment.
Okay. So, actually, I forgot to do this because you mentioned when vacancies happen in the representation from any state, this is actually a responsibility. This is a role and responsibility, but it's not the federal government's role. This is for the states. That clearly states that when vacancies do happen from the representation from any state, the executive of that state shall basically write a writ of election to for that person to be replaced. Now, I believe that they can also, you know, send in a representative to replace them. But it is a role and responsibility that is granted to the state within the Constitution. See, most people think that the Constitution is only, you know, directed towards the federal government. There are very specific things that the states are either restricted, they've got a role, responsibility, and so forth. So, okay. Now, Section 3. Go ahead.
Okay. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof, for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote.
Okay. Okay, so that right there is a role and responsibility, and what you're going to actually read all the way in this next portion of a paragraph is another role and responsibility. Go ahead.
Immediately after, they shall be assembled. In consequence of the first election, they shall be divided as equally as may be into three classes. The seats of the senators of the first class shall be vacated at the expiration of the second year, of the second class at the expiration of the fourth year, and of the third class at the expiration of the sixth year, so that one third may be chosen every second year. And if vacancies happen by resignation or otherwise during the recess of the legislature of any state, the executive thereof may make temporary appointments until the next meeting of the legislature, which shall then fill such vacancies.
Okay, so that right there, that last part that, and if vacancies shall happen, that is a state responsibility. So if a senator basically is removed, dies, or what have you, this is how they're supposed to be replaced. Now, the 17th Amendment kind of mucked this up, but that's okay. Now, the next thing you're going to read, no person shall be a senator. This is a standard. This is a qualification of eligibility. Go ahead.
No person shall be a senator who shall not have attained to the age of 30 years and been 9 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state for which he shall be chosen.
Okay, so you have to be 30 years of age. You have to be a citizen for 9 years. And you also have to be an inhabitant of that state. I mean, it's sad that they even had to include that. But anyway, go ahead. The next one, the vice president.
Yeah, the vice president of the United States shall be president of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided. The Senate shall choose their other officers and also a president pro tempore in the absence of the vice president or when he shall exercise the office of president of the United States.
Okay, keep going.
The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be an oath of affirmation. When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of two-thirds of the members present.
Okay.
Judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualifications to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States, but the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to the law.
Okay, so what you just read, those four little paragraphs, those right there, or five, those are roles and responsibilities. And as a matter of fact, because I wasn't keeping track of what parts are being violated, many of these little parts are being violated because we're not actually following this. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that they talk about, it both in the prerequisites of a representative, the prerequisites of a elector, and the prerequisites of a senator, those are the only hard requirements that can be placed upon a person who chooses to be a representative or a senator or an elector. Which means that if your state basically has a primary where they can down-select in that party any electors, any representatives, or any senators, then that's actually a violation, because what that does is it allows the party to control actually who will represent you. Now, you got to remember that the Senate, in context to the Constitution, the senators were actually appointed by the state legislature, not by the people. So it was a little bit different because it wasn't open for an election. They moved it over into a general election, which means that every person that wants to become senator has to actually, you know, has the right to go to the general election. The fact that they have a primary. So what they do, and this is how the states have basically co-opted political control, is the state will basically say, if you run as a party member of the Democrat or Republican Party, then there's really no requirements because we're going to down-select you. And if you're not the party's choice, then we're not letting you move forward. The Constitution doesn't allow that. The Constitution does not allow a party to actually dictate who can move forward into that general election. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so when did all of that switch?
That all started in 1856 when the parties tried to create control over the presidential selection of the electors. And that's when they started moving towards the popular vote and moving away from the elector, which is why today nobody even knows who the electors are. When in going through this, we've actually showed and proven that the electors are to be chosen by the people. We're not to choose who the president is. Whoever's, you know, out there running for president, that's who the electors, you know, they need to know, and they need to determine who they're going to support, and they're the ones that run the campaign. In the big scheme of things, the framers realized that it was just unfathomable that one person could run a national campaign. How could this one person become elected when they have to travel around between all the states and get the consensus of the people to follow their platform, to follow, you know, to support what they want to do as president? So the electors basically communicated with those candidates, and they aligned with a particular candidate, says, I'm going to be your elector. And they ran the local campaigns, and whoever got elected chose the president that they felt was best, the person that they were representing, or the people that they were representing. And in those days, it wasn't really like, I'm going to give you chickens, because back in those days, you know, a chicken in every pot would have been unconstitutional. It would have been illegal, because basically you're bribing the people, a quid pro quo. You vote for me, I give you this. And that is absolutely unconstitutional. The ability to actually make promises, political promises, in handing something over to the people is really, on its face, and actually in the letter of the law, it is a violation of the law. And so we're going into a break. So with that, I'm going to take a quick pause. And when we come back, we'll get into Section 4 of Article 1. And we will be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so one thing I kind of skipped over, but this is language that literally lays the line of ineligibility. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a jump to the 14th Amendment, and I'm going to read the language in the 14th Amendment so you can kind of see how that language is literally being duplicated as a standard. So let me see here. The 14th Amendment, Section 3. Now, so you already read this. No person shall be a senator who shall have not attained the age of 36. In other words, you can't be a senator if you've attained the age of 36. In other words, that's really a standard. Now, when we look at Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, it is the exact same language, but it's expanded to all public servants. And what it says is no person shall be a senator, representative of Congress, an elector of president, or an elector of the vice president, or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States. Any office, or under any state. So, in other words, you can't be in a state office or a federal office at all after having taken this oath as a member of whatever body or whatever job you have. You've taken an oath to be in office as an officer of the state or a member of any of the states or any of these positions. And that oath requires you to support the Constitution of the United States and then shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the Constitution or given aid and comfort to the enemies of the Constitution, not our combatant enemies. We're talking about domestic enemies. Then you can't be in office. In other words, this is a hard line standard. You violate your oath, you are gone. This supersedes impeachment. This does not give you a right of due process. This is a right of eligibility. So when we look at Article 1, Section 3, and that no state shall, no person shall be, that is a hard standard. Okay? Does that make sense?
It does. Well, I mean, at the very last sentence says,
right,
made by a vote of 2/3 of each house remove such disability.
That's right. So what that means is that the only way you can ever get back into public service or back into the military or back into any form of officer service of government is the 2/3 of both houses of Congress must actually vote to relieve you or to remove that banishment from you.
Okay, I see.
Okay. So just wanted to emphasize, because most of what we've been reading is either state responsibilities or standards or what have you. But as we move down into Section 4 now we talk about elections, okay? So go ahead and let's read Section 4. And just remember that the beginning, most of this, at the very front of what you're going to read, is being violated. So go ahead.
Wait, hold on, I gotta go back up.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Section 3.
I'm going to skip around like this just because we need to connect these dots.
Okay. The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, but the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations, except as to the places of choosing senators.
All right, so that right there is really a state responsibility and a state role. In other words, the times, places, manners of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. In other words, that this is something in the Constitution that the states have to do this. Now, Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations, except as to the places of choosing senators. Now, that was changed because of the 17th Amendment. But the reason it says may is because they realized that there were hostilities. We had lots of enemies. And a state could actually be under siege of an invasion or, you know, being attacked in an insurgency or what have you. And so they made this little caveat that allowed Congress to step in if the state could not do this. Now, technically, under COVID, when the state legislatures were dismissed and the governor decided that they were going to change time, place, and manner of holding the elections for the senators, representatives, as well as the president, then Congress could have prescribed that. But in 2020, that was a presidential election. So there is even a more stringent requirement that we'll get to in Article 2. But the point is that your governor can't touch that. Your Secretary of State can't touch those things. They can't create the places, times, and manners for the holding of elections. Only your state, only the representatives of the people. So just so you understand, folks, we are a Republican form of government. All responsibilities really lay on the shoulders of your legislators at the county, state, and federal level. They're the ones with the bulk of the powers and responsibilities, not the judges, not the executives. They're basically just figureheads. The judges only really just look at the case and they make a decision if they even have that power, because 9 times out of 10, most things need to be in front of a jury. And the juries are the ones that actually decide without any manipulation or any controls by the bench or by the judge. So just wanted to really stress this, that what we're looking at right here is a role and responsibility that literally is for the states. And what we want to do is actually kind of go through the next part, because each house shall be the judge of the election. So go ahead and hit that one now.
Okay. Each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns and qualifications of its own members, and a majority of each shall constitute a quorum to do business, but a smaller number may adjourn from day to day and may be authorized to compel the attendance of absent members in such manner and under such penalties as each house may provide.
Okay, so this is a standard as well, and this is levied upon the Congress, both houses of Congress. And what it basically says is each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members. So if all of a sudden you have a senator that gets elected who is not a citizen, who is responsible for allowing that to happen? Or if that senator actually gets into the Senate, such as Kamala Harris, then who should actually be held accountable for not actually following this responsibility? So when we look at it, it is the Senate's responsibility to make sure that Kamala Harris was, one, qualified as a citizen, and that the election was held, that there was no voter fraud or election fraud. So what I'm really laying out here, because I know it kind of gets a little confusing, because this is a pretty big pot here, and this is a pretty big problem. Every 2 years, we're electing senators and representatives, and every election, they have the responsibility of making sure that those elections returns and qualifications are being met. So in other words, they have no control over the holding of the election. In other words, the states have to do it, and they have to do it right. And they have to get it right. And if they don't, then they actually have to go after and say, you failed. You failed, state legislature, because you provided an election system that basically, you know, provided an outcome for one person instead of allowing the people to choose. Because they're actually supposed to ensure that these elections are being held fairly. They don't have the ability to create the laws, but they do have the requirement of ensuring that they are done fairly. And so when we
look... That's the Senate? Senate has to do that?
Both houses. It says each house. Each house. Okay. So the House of Representatives and the House of Senators both have this requirement. And in 1811, there was a gentleman who was seated by the House of Representatives as a representative, an incumbent returning back to office. And come to find out, he actually didn't win. He basically just showed up and said, I'm taking my seat. And what ended up happening, the real winner showed up and used a First Amendment petition to the House of Representatives and challenged the fact that they actually seated, because there's a process. You know, you have to come back and so you're, oh, here's my returns. You know, I've won. And then they actually go through this process of swearing you in so that you can be seated. This guy challenged that. He said, you seated the wrong guy. And if you go through this, this is really a good story, because the House of Representatives, the Speaker of the House, actually took the responsibility of going and actually investigating this. They went and talked to the sheriff in Virginia, and the sheriff actually did account, or the sheriffs of the counties where this person was representing, and they basically said, yeah, that person actually did win. And so they did a tally and everything else, and they came back and they removed the person that they seated, and then they sat, or they basically, you know, swore in and seated the real winner. So don't tell me that they don't have this responsibility of ensuring the accuracy of the outcome. Does that make sense?
I mean, I suppose that would have been a lot easier to do back then, just because communication wasn't so quickly.
Absolutely. So it did take time, right? And that's one of the reasons why the elections were held like in the fall or something like that. And then they basically seated the new president in March, and that Congress was seated, you know, maybe in February or later. But they didn't do it in the beginning of January because travel and so forth was very hard.
Right.
So anyway, I just wanted to point this out because that's not being followed. They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. But anyway, go ahead. Each house may determine.
Each house may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and with the concurrence of 2/3, expel a member. Oh.
There you go. Now, so hold on here. What's really important here is that we now have, based on the 14th Amendment, Section 3, they now don't have to require 2/3 to expel. This has been modified, because if a House of Representatives member had actually violated their oath because they voted for something that was literally a violation of the Constitution, which means that they supported an insurrection against, because if they vote for a law that would be a direct violation of the Constitution by not granting themselves an amendment or, you know, making sure that they have that appropriate power. And a good case in point is healthcare. When they passed and voted for healthcare, that was obviously nothing enumerated. They had no authority to create that law. Every representative that failed to actually vote against that or voted for it. So if you did nothing and you actually allowed this to move forward, that means you're giving aid and comfort to the enemy of the Constitution, which everybody that voted for health care, the Obamacare, the ACA, every person that voted for that in Congress violated their oath of office and needed to be removed immediately. Because they were, and this goes back even further, because they've been doing this for a long time. When they voted for the Department of Interior, the Department of Home in 1849, every member of the House of Representatives and every member of the state that vote, or the Senate, that voted for the passing and creation of the Department of Home, they violated their oath and they should have been removed. However, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment didn't exist yet. So at this point, it would have required two-thirds of their membership. And this is where they became corrupt. And they became corrupt all the way back to the Missouri Compromise. In 1820, when the majority of the House of Representatives and the Senate agreed that this federal government could now inflict slavery upon states, that which was a direct violation of the Constitution, every person that voted for that should have been expelled, but they didn't have Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, and it would have required two-thirds. And just remember that the majority of them voted for it. So how could you even get two-thirds to even be honest enough to say, yeah, that was wrong? You see my point?
Yeah.
So I mean, this was a huge problem within the Constitution.
Yeah, all the way back to 1820.
1820, when they all agreed to do something wrong, or I should say the majority of the House and the Senate, they agreed. This is when our politics literally started going sideways fast in saying, as long as the two sides can agree, or they have a one side has a majority, then we can get away with doing what we want because you can't expel us. So this, again, goes to the divine hand of providence in giving us the 14th Amendment. Anybody that says that 14th Amendment is a problem, they do not understand, nor have they recognized and realized his hand in that. Because what we have in the Constitution basically didn't, because these men, when they wrote this back in 1789, they couldn't fathom people without scruples being in office. They felt that the character, these were the best of society, that these men would actually stand up and do the right thing always. And we quickly learned, as we went through the cod fishery bounties and so forth, we already started seeing how they were trying to take a tax, or the creation of the bank. That actually passed based on this concept of implied powers, which don't exist in this Constitution. No, nowhere while we read this Constitution, while you go through this, just if you could keep a mental note, if you can find implied powers, you tell me, where they have implied powers, where we can produce some implication that we can do it, then it's implied. We can do it. So anyway, go ahead. And I think the next thing we're doing is the each house shall keep a journal, right?
Okay. Now, each house shall keep a journal of its proceedings and from time to time publish the expecting such parts as may in their judgment require secrecy, and the years and the yeas and nays of the members of either house on any question shall, at the desire of one-fifth of those present, be entered on the journal.
Yeah, so in other words, this is kind of nice because it only requires a minority to hold everybody accountable. In other words, if one-fifth of the people there say, hey, we want this on record, and actually it's gotten to the point where it just takes one person to actually say it, they automatically do it because they realize that there's always a contingent of, you know, haters out there that don't like what the party or what have you is. And so it's the Freedom Caucus or the communist movement. Oh, we don't like the fact that you're doing, you know, things that are actually constitutional, and we want to make sure that we can hold you accountable. If we get challenged by some good person because everybody in our district are communists and they keep voting us in.
Right.
When we understand Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, technically, the governor and the state legislature, as we look at how they vote at the state level, we can actually reach in and say that vote was a violation of your oath. You don't have to, because Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is not something Congress has the power. This is a blanketed power that we, the people, can demand the removal of a person if we've articulated how they've directly violated their oath of office. That's why First Amendment petitions are so critical. Because once you've articulated precisely how and what they did was a direct violation, they are no longer eligible. This is not... You got to remember, due process is guaranteed when a person's life, liberty, or property is to be taken from them. What we're talking about under Section 3 is a removal from office. It's not their life. It's not putting them in jail. It's not, you know, taking any property from them. They get to keep all their property. It's just that you no longer have the right or the ability to be in office. So due process is not even afforded to these people. So in other words, when people go, well, I want to challenge this, you know, and basically run over to the court and say, protect me. I want to go through a court process so you can protect me and overturn, you know, this mad assertion of how I violated the Constitution. Court has no jurisdiction over it. Does that make sense?
It does, although in this day and age, they would just assume that the court did and allow them to.
Absolutely correct, because that's exactly how far we've gone outside the bounds of the Constitution. Okay, so, and one of the things you mentioned also is that they're supposed to keep these proceedings accepting such parts that they judge as secret. Now, everything they do today is secret. So this is where... I believe there needs to be an amendment basically giving the state legislatures the authority to determine the parameters of secrecy. And I say that, and I so I'm opening a rat hole, but this is really important because we talked about secrecy. As the parties to the compact, we have realized, or I should say, because the states are the parties to the compact, and I think it is empirical data has proven that they do anything and everything they can to hide their malfeasance, to hide their, you know, their attacks against the people in the states. So the states actually have to step in and say, you know what? You used to do a decent job in maintaining secrecy and protecting our sovereignty, but now we see you as the threat. And we can't trust your judgment on secrecy anymore. So we will now oversee everything. So when Snowden basically went on his narcissistic run of fame and basically said, look at how bad America is, what he should have done was he should have gone into the state legislature, the state, whatever state you're in, you go to the state house and you basically goes, I've got information that we need to go into a SCIF, a sensitive compartmented information facility where secrecies can be exposed without the risk of the wrong people hearing it and receiving it. So Snowden would then have been escorted into a SCIF with legislators of that state. He would have exposed everything to those people because they would have had clearances to understand the importance of keeping these things secret. Because what Snowden did was he exposed methods, sources, and so forth that actually made the United States intelligence collection capabilities vulnerable. But anyway, so going into the SCIF, he would have exposed this, and then all states being connected with the secure communications, all of that would have been transmitted from that SCIF to all the other 49 states. So simultaneously, when somebody comes in and says the federal government is doing something wrong and they're hiding it behind secrecy, boom, it is broadcast to all 50 state legislatures so that then the 50 state legislatures would then go in and then they could all quickly engage and say, federal government, you have no authority to be spying on Americans. That is violation of our Fourth Amendment rights. And therefore start asking for heads and actually removing people. Because remember, Section 3 empowers them. No person can even be in the military or any formal office if you're under oath. And this is why it's so important that we start holding people and making sure that anybody that is in a service capacity is taking an oath. Because we have to have the ability to hold everybody who is going to be at the altar of power, that mantle of power, that we have to be able to hold them accountable to any deviation. Now, I'm not a scorched earth person, but I believe that we've gone so far down the line that we have such evil at that mantle of power that we need to start scorching a few people just to make an example so that everybody realizes the magnitude of, one, how wrong it is, and the power of the people.
Absolutely.
But I think we need to start moving quickly towards, you know, not necessarily forgiveness, but a first and final warning. You know, I believe that if it seems evident that the person really didn't know and they didn't ask, okay, but that's bad. You should have asked. Can we even do this? Is this legitimate? Because that should come out of every person's mouth who is in a position of responsibility or service, a public service. But we need to get people to actually start challenging on their own. Hey, do we even have the authority to do this? Because as they start doing that, as they push back while they're in that circle of trust, then now all of a sudden we're going in the right direction, because then we don't necessarily have to have that scorched earth. But right now we have people that are deliberately pulling the trigger on killing and executing us via, you know, the chemtrails or whatever these harmful things that they're putting in our food, medications, vaccinations, these things like Fauci, yeah. That should have been a capital offense. Fauci should have been held accountable. He should have actually been removed immediately, then tried for his crimes of allowing such harmful things to move forward and mandate those things. So you see my point?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. And how come they haven't?
Right, right. Okay. So I believe if we're done there, then we actually do that last little paragraph before 6. Because we got 1 minute, we can read that, and then we'll stop at 6. We'll go into 6 when we come back tomorrow.
Neither House during the session of Congress shall, without the consent of the other, adjourn for more than 3 days, nor to any other place than in which the two houses shall be sitting.
Okay, so a lot of the stuff that we've read are roles and responsibilities. Some of these are standards, but none of these are powers of regulation that Congress can start making laws inflicting upon the states or what have you. There are some assertions, like we pointed out, they may do those things, but that was only as a fail-safe if the states couldn't do it. Now, the other thing that we kind of want to do here is when we talk about this adjourning, it was mentioned that they didn't need to have a quorum, that there could be a couple of members that would be gone. Because we were an agrarian society, because this was really a part-time job, many of these men needed to travel home to do business or what have you, so they needed to have a leave of absence. So it allowed them to basically parse out, okay, I'll go tend my fields, you know, this next week, and you can go do them in 2 weeks or what have you, because they managed it that way so that everybody could get their own things done. I want to thank you for joining us, and Tammy, thank you for being a part of this. And so with that, obviously we're out of time, but we'll be back tomorrow and we'll be going into Article 1, Section 6 as we take off and keep going through the Constitution for you, because somebody has to do it, and that leaves us. We'll have to do it. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.